Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 1st of June, these are our main stories. President Biden has urged Hamas to accept a new peace deal he says Israel has put forward, saying it's time for the war to end. Donald Trump has confirmed he'll appeal against his historic criminal conviction in his latest tirade against his trial. Aid agencies have warned that Sudan will face widespread famine unless they're given access to regions ravaged by the civil war. Also in this podcast,
this rare tropical plant is found only in New Caledonia in the Pacific Ocean and on a few neighbouring islands. It belongs to a group of little-known ferns that have been around since before the time of the dinosaurs.
A tiny plant has entered the record books for having the most DNA material of any living thing. In his first major address outlining how the war in Gaza might end, President Biden has put forward what he says is a new Israeli proposal. The three-part plan would begin with a six-week ceasefire in which the Israel Defense Forces, or IDF, would withdraw from populated areas of Gaza. There would also be a surge of humanitarian aid, as well as an exchange of some hostages for Palestinian prisoners. The deal would eventually lead to a permanent cessation of hostilities and a major reconstruction plan for Gaza. Mr. Biden urged Hamas to accept the deal.
This is truly a decisive moment. Hamas says it wants a ceasefire. This deal is an opportunity to prove whether they really mean it. For months, people all over the world have called for ceasefire. Now it's time to raise your voices and demand that Hamas come to the table.
Hamas has said it's ready to respond positively. But even though Mr. Biden said this was an Israeli plan, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has responded by insisting the war would only end once Hamas's military and governmental capabilities had been destroyed. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Hugo Bashega, assesses this latest peace initiative.
President Biden called it a comprehensive proposal that has been put forward by Israel and that has been presented to Hamas. And some of the key points are familiar points because they were included in earlier efforts to reach a deal in Gaza. This includes a first phase, which would include a six-week temporary ceasefire in Gaza. It would see the release of some of the hostages being held in Gaza in exchange for Palestinians who are being held in Israeli jails. Then this would pave the way for a second phase. And I think this is the key point here in this proposal, because President Biden talked about a permanent ceasefire. In other words, the end of the war in Gaza, and that the Americans would guarantee this permanent ceasefire. Now, President Biden also said that Hamas has been degraded to an extent that it doesn't have the ability to carry out another attack like October the 7th. So obviously trying to address security concerns from the Israeli authorities. Still, this plan is likely to face opposition from some far-right supporters of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who have rejected the idea of reaching a deal with Hamas. They say that the war must continue, and that military pressure is the only way to guarantee the release of the hostages who are still in Gaza. And for Hamas, I think the president is trying to frame this proposal as something that is impossible to be rejected. Now, the president described this as a truly decisive moment, and he said it is time for this war to end and for the day after in Gaza to begin.
Hugo Bashega. The US election campaign has moved into uncharted territory. On Friday, a day after Donald Trump's historic criminal conviction, the former president gave a long and at times rambling speech at Trump Tower in New York, angrily attacking his opponents, denouncing the trial and insisting he's innocent.
As far as the trial itself, it was very unfair. We weren't allowed to use our election expert. It was a rigged trial. We wanted a venue change where we could have a fair trial We didn't get it. We wanted a judge that wasn't conflicted. And obviously he didn't do that. Nobody's ever seen anything like it.
Mr. Trump has confirmed that he will appeal. He was found guilty of falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment to a porn star. He'll be sentenced in July and could face jail, although experts believe a fine is more likely. With less than 6 months to go until the US presidential election, the Biden campaign said Mr. Trump was desperate and unhinged. President Biden said the threat Mr. Trump posed to America's democracy had never been greater, and the ballot box was the only way to keep him out of the White House.
It's reckless, it's dangerous, it's irresponsible for anyone to say this was rigged just because they don't like the verdict.
Well, we got more from our correspondent, Neda Torfik, who was outside Trump Tower on a rather noisy Fifth Avenue.
Essentially, what we have is the world's media, protesters who support and do not support Donald Trump have all basically migrated from Lower Manhattan and the courthouse to here. And so often we have loud trucks with big Trump flags and Trump music blasting, his supporters passionately saying this is a witch hunt, very much echoing his claims. But we also have protesters shouting, lock him up, holding signs that say guilty, Don the felon. Quite an atmosphere outside of Trump Tower as Americans absorb this historic moment.
And the man himself repeating many of his claims about how this trial was unfair, how it was rigged. And the Biden campaign are calling him desperate and unhinged. It seems that the Biden campaign think that this trial is to their benefit.
Look, I mean, Donald Trump, many expected him to come out in this speech with kind of fiery rhetoric, angry, defiance. And many noted that he maintained a demeanor that looked very much like he did at the end of the trial, a bit worn out. He, instead of launching into that kind of campaign rhetoric that would normally fire up his base, he just briefly touched on the economy, inflation, the border. But he focused instead on this stream of consciousness, venting about the judge, about the whole process, the whole trial, witnesses, saying and confirming that he would be appealing his verdict. And the real only applause he got in his speech was when he mentioned that he had raised nearly $35 million in small donations in the 12 hours since his conviction in the hush money trial. So Democrats seized on that, calling him unhinged, saying that he is defeated. I think we are going to definitely see Democrats using this verdict, the fact that he is a convicted felon, to their advantage. But we'll see in the kind of weeks and months ahead how this impacts Trump politically, because nobody really knows at this point yet.
Neda Torfik. Well, another one of our correspondents in the US, Gary O'Donohue, considers how Trump's conviction and its aftermath might both affect the presidential election and US society as a whole.
A country which so often holds itself up as an example to the rest of the world now finds itself in an exceptional place it would never have chosen. But what hasn't changed is that Donald Trump remains the Republicans' choice for president, despite his conviction, and there's nothing to stop him continuing to run for the White House. Indeed, among many of his voters, this will galvanize their support even more and have them reaching deeper into their pockets. Given the timescale of any appeal, it's highly unlikely he will be able to clear his name before Election Day, whatever the merits of his case. And given this is a conviction brought in an individual state, he will not have the power to pardon himself should he become president. The irony of this particular trial and verdict is that this was considered to be the least of all his legal problems. But with three other criminal cases mired in delays, two of them relating to election interference, this is the one that has altered the landscape of US politics forever.
Gary O'Donohue. 19 international humanitarian agencies have warned that unless the warring sides in Sudan give them access to civilians caught up in the fighting that has been raging for more than a year, then a famine will take hold in large parts of the country. Around 9 million people have been displaced since the civil war erupted last April. The agencies say aid workers trying to help them are being killed, injured and harassed. Will Ross reports.
So far, the warring sides in Sudan have paid no attention to the calls for an end to the fighting, which is causing so much suffering. 19 humanitarian agencies have made a new appeal for civilians to be protected and for aid to be allowed in. The organisations that are being blocked from delivering aid say there's a rapidly shrinking window to get seeds to farmers. Because of the war, there's already widespread hunger in Sudan. Millions of children are acutely malnourished, and now a warning that famine is quickly closing in.
Will Ross. It was once one of China's largest companies, a sprawling property empire that epitomised the Chinese housing boom. But in the past few years, Evergrande has seen its debts balloon to more than $300 billion after the authorities introduced measures to curb the amount real estate developers can borrow. In January, a Hong Kong court ordered it to be liquidated. And now it's been dealt another blow, with Chinese regulators fining it more than $500 million for alleged financial misconduct. Our Asia Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, told me more about the massive fine.
$577 million, a huge amount of money, leaving aside the fact that can this indebted company actually pay this fine for essentially fraudulent business practices, inflating both its revenue and its profit, actually inflated its revenue by about $80 billion. How on earth it could have done that, I'm not quite sure. That's what it's been fined for. And that revenue, inflated revenue, allowed it to issue bonds to raise even more money. So that's where the fraudulent business practices come in. Also, the founder of the company, Hui Ka-yen, has been fined himself and banned from trading securities for life. But he's got more serious problems he faces at the moment because he's under investigation.
And Evergrande now has a dubious honour of being the world's most indebted developer, with more than $300 billion US dollars worth of total liabilities. How did it get into such a mess?
Essentially what it did, its business model was, we take in money from people who want to buy a house before we've built the house, and then we use that money to buy more land. Then we sell more properties, which is going to be based on that land, and we use the money we get from that to build the houses that the first people gave us money for. So it's a bit like a Ponzi scheme. And it all came crashing down in 2020 when the Chinese government said, you can't hold that much debt, and everything began to unwind from there. And essentially now, it's difficult to see what the company is. A Hong Kong court has said it needs to wind up. It's difficult to see a lot of these properties which it's taken money for, which haven't been built, whether they're going to get built. I'm not quite sure what exists of the company at the moment. It's kind of someone described it, a controlled implosion.
And it's not just Evergrande. Much of China's real estate market is in serious difficulties. And this is all a big drag on an economy that's already struggling.
Yeah, I mean, the property market in China was worth about a quarter of the economy. So it's a big driver of the economy. If you imagine 30, 40 years ago, nobody had a house in China or nobody owned a house in China. Then everybody started buying houses. So it takes a long time to work through 1.4 billion people. You can't keep building houses forever. That's partly the problem as well.
Mickey Bristow. Scientists have discovered the earliest and most distant galaxy ever observed. Using infrared scanners aboard NASA's James Webb Space Telescope, they determined the collection of stars formed just 290 million years after the Big Bang, so more than 13 billion years ago. Astronomers say the discovery has implications for our understanding of the dawn of the universe. Here's our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
It's just a faint red smudge, but the detectors on the James Webb telescope are in no doubt that this galaxy, a large collection of stars, is at a prodigious distance. Astronomers say the observatory is seeing the object when the universe was less than 300 million years old. Put another way, if the cosmos is 13.8 billion years old, James Webb is seeing the galaxy when the universe was only 2% of its current age. The most interesting aspect of the discovery is not the great distance, however. It's the galaxy's large size and brightness. Researchers are struggling to explain the presence of so mature an object so early in the nascent universe. Professor Catherine Haymans is the Astronomer Royal for Scotland.
We thought that we would see these early galaxies with this new telescope, but we didn't think we'd see quite so many and that they'd be quite so bright. How has the universe managed to form these quite big, bright galaxies in just a couple of hundred million years? So back to the drawing board for astronomers. We always like a good question, a good puzzle.
When space agencies spent $10 billion developing James Webb, they promised it would do remarkable things. 2 years into operations, that enormous investment is starting to pay back.
Jonathan Amos. Still to come. The four members of the legendary Swedish pop group ABBA have reunited to receive one of their country's top honours. Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. President Volodymyr Zelensky has hailed the decision by some of Ukraine's Western allies to allow his country's forces to hit Russian military targets inside Russia on the border with the Kharkiv region. Previously, Western countries supplying weapons had done so on the condition that they weren't fired over the Ukraine-Russia border. But now Germany, the US and others have said they believe a change in policy is necessary as Russian forces continue to bombard Kharkiv, a move President Zelensky has long been calling for.
I think that using any weapon, Western kind of weapon, on the territory of Russia, it's a question of time. I think so. Otherwise, it's not about the just peace, and they can stay just on their territory through the borderline, just attack us and kill like it now is going on.
But there are still restrictions. President Biden says American-supplied weapons can only be used to hit targets in Russia near the Kharkiv region. Given this, I asked our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, how much of a difference this decision by Western allies could make.
Quite a lot. This is primarily about self-defense. We're not talking here about suddenly authorizing Ukraine to hit the Kremlin or something like that. This is about providing Ukraine with the tools to defend Kharkiv, its second city, which is getting absolutely pummeled. There's no doubt that President Putin would like to take Kharkiv. It would be their biggest success since the full-scale invasion of February 22. They've made some incremental land gains, the Russians, across that border, but primarily they're looking to put themselves in a position, in fact they already have done, where they can bombard Kharkiv. And they're killing a lot of people every day, civilians. And the Ukrainians' complaint is that Russia is hiding behind its border, firing these drones, missiles and bombs at them, and they are not allowed to use Western-supplied weapons to hit back at them. So Germany, France, the UK, NATO, and now the US have all agreed that, yes, they can use them in self-defense. Now, Moscow has, throughout the full-scale invasion, at each stage warned of terrible retribution, of dangerous escalation, each time, for example, the West provided men battle tanks or provided F-16s, which have yet to actually been deployed operationally, or to provide long-range artillery. But all of those things have happened, and Russia hasn't yet retaliated.
And yet Ukraine needs to hit back. It feels that it's been restricted, whereas Russia's been able to get this help from North Korea, from Iran, and the use of dual-use technology from China. This is a very difficult calculation for the West, isn't it? Because it needs to avoid that danger of escalation and the possibility of a wider war. But at the same time, it has to support Ukraine to deter the Russians. And it's just a very, very complicated sort of balancing act it has there. And that's why there are still these restrictions from the US in particular on the use of long-range missiles.
It's a game of brickmanship. And you're right, there's a lot of nuance involved here. So the way Moscow sees it, Crimea is Russian territory. All those four oblasts that it has invaded and partially occupied, Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson and Zaporizhia, it considers to be a part of the territory of the Russian Federation. That's not the way most of the rest of the world sees it. So theoretically, those weapons that are already being deployed to hit Russian targets in those occupied areas of Ukraine are hitting Russian soil. So you could say, in a way, nothing is really changing. What I think the West would be very keen to avoid is seeing not just Western-supplied weapons, but any powerful Ukrainian weapons being used to hit a strategic target, say, Moscow, the Kremlin. You know, Ukrainian drones are hitting Russian oil refineries deep within Russia. The US doesn't like that because, for a start, it restricts the amount of refined oil that's coming onto the world market and therefore drives prices up, which isn't good for US consumers at the pumps. But it also worries it about escalation. So far, the West has called Putin's bluff, and he's turned out to have a lot of empty threats. But sooner or later, the fear is, I think, he will retaliate in some form.
Frank Gardner. Well, Frank was talking there about the dangers of how the Kremlin might react to this latest change in Western policy on Ukraine. With more on Moscow's response, here's our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, talking to Nuala McGovern.
The reaction has been quite angry from senior Russian officials. Dmitry Medvedev, who was a former Russian president and now deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, he wrote on social media that Russia views any long-range weapons passed to Ukraine by the West as weapons controlled by NATO personnel and therefore views NATO countries as participating in the war. And he had this warning of Russian retaliatory strikes on military hardware, on sites, soldiers in NATO countries. And he said that the current armed conflict with the West is developing according to the worst-case scenario, and he suggested that Russia could use tactical nuclear weapons against Ukraine, saying this is not a nuclear bluff.
So that could be interpreted as a change of tone?
Well, you have to remember that nuclear saber-rattling is not new. I mean, we've heard so much of it over the last 2 years plus from Mr. Medvedev and from other Russian officials, from President Putin as well. And you could construct an argument that says they've been saying this kind of thing since the very beginning. So is this simply a bluff? But I think the Russians in the last few days have been going out of the way to try to make the argument that, no, this is not a bluff, that they could be put in a situation where they have to respond. If you look at the language in the pro-Kremlin newspapers in recent days, it has been shrill. There was one tabloid today, Moskovsky Komsomolets, that wrote this about how it thinks Russia should respond now to the West. It said, "We need to hit them and hit them hard. A shock is needed to sober up the enemy's brains." And it even suggested a Russian military strike on a part of Poland to stop Western weapons getting to Ukraine. That is the kind of thing you read about now in the Russian newspapers.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. French security forces say they've foiled an attack that was being planned for the Paris Olympics starting in late July, when millions of visitors are expected. France's Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said an 18-year-old man of Chechen origin who was arrested earlier this month was believed to have been preparing an attack at the stadium in Saint-Étienne during the football tournament. Hugh Schofield reports.
According to the Interior Ministry, initial evidence suggests he was planning an Islamist-inspired attack in the main stadium at Saint-Étienne, which is where a number of Olympic football matches will take place from late July. The ministry said that the man planned to attack spectators and police and hoped to die a martyr's death. French media report that the man was caught after exchanging encrypted messages with known Islamists. Pictures and videos of the stadium were found on his phone and computer. Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin congratulated the intelligence services for this first success in stopping a plot targeting the Games.
Hugh Schofield. Hackers are attempting to sell what they say is confidential information on millions of customers and staff at Santander. The Spanish bank confirmed that data had been stolen and apologised. The hackers, called Shiny Hunters, claim to have bank account details for 30 million Santander clients in Spain, Uruguay and Chile. This comes days after the gang claimed to have stolen the details of 500 million customers of the US website Ticketmaster. Some cyber experts say claims could be a publicity stunt by Shiny Hunters to draw attention to a new hacking forum that was relaunched recently after being taken down by police. For more on the hacking of Santander, David Harper spoke to our cyber correspondent, Joe Tidy.
They're saying, the hackers, that they have managed to get the account details for 30 million different customers of Santander. They are in Chile, Spain and Uruguay. They've also said that they have got all of the staff contact details and information of the global company, which is obviously potentially a lot of people. That's 200,000 people worldwide this could be affecting, who are staff of Santander. The hackers are claiming that of that 30 million, they've got 6 million account numbers and balances. So I've been getting my black hat hacker hat on and working out, right, what can you do with that information? And it doesn't take a big leap of the imagination to come up with some pretty nasty secondary attacks if you know people's account numbers and their names and how much money they've got in their accounts.
And this has affected some of the bank services as well?
No, actually, they're saying that all services are running as normal, and they're having to, obviously, this is a giant task for them to contact every one of those potential customers affected. Santander has said that there has been a breach. They've confirmed the staff element of this hack, but they haven't confirmed the number of customers. So we're still waiting on numbers from them. And sometimes when these hackers go on hacking forums and start selling their data in batches, they do exaggerate what they've got. And we're very wary of publicising that. But in this case, it is a pretty concerning situation for potentially millions. And it is partially confirmed, of course, by Santander themselves.
And this is in contrast to the story we were running this time yesterday concerning the same hacking group who claimed, we believe, to have undertaken a similar theft of data from a major ticket company.
The Ticketmaster hack came out as a big news story yesterday. That one, in terms of numbers affected, is far, far more. That's 560 million people around the world who could be, according to the hackers, affected by the Ticketmaster breach. But Ticketmaster hasn't said anything, and we're all a little bit wary of that one because there hasn't been any confirmation from official sources on that. But certainly, if the same group today has put, overnight, they posted this Santander hack, which has proven to be at least partially true, that does give some credence to this gang called Shiny Hunters.
Yes, because they're quite a prominent gang who have undertaken acts like this in the past.
Yeah, that's right. They have proven to have hacked in 2021 lots of data. 70 million customer accounts were hacked in a breach, which of AT&T, the American telecoms giant, and they successfully sold that data and it was all confirmed. So we do have to take them quite seriously, these hackers. But at the same time, of course, there's also this strange situation now where they are trying to sell these giant sets of data for a lot of money, and they're very eye-catching sales, and it's a brand new website that they have started themselves. So you've got to say, well, hang on a minute, is this all part of some sort of publicity stunt?
And just very quickly, if you're a customer of Santander or potentially a customer of Ticketmaster, what's the best advice at the moment?
I would sit and I would wait for either Ticketmaster, if that is true, or Santander, if you are one of the customers affected by this, to give you some advice. Don't panic, but they will tell you what to do. And that might be a case of changing your bank details or your card, you know, your credit cards and that kind of thing. But I'm afraid, yes, it's a case of sitting and waiting, and then be very, very vigilant of any suspicious phone calls or emails, that kind of thing.
Our cyber correspondent, Joe Tidy. A tiny fern has entered the Guinness World Records for having the most DNA material of any living thing. DNA is like an instruction manual telling an organism how to live and survive. Scientists say that when unravelled, the plant's genome would reach more than 100 metres. That's 50 times more than that of humans. More details from Helen Briggs.
This rare tropical plant is found only in New Caledonia in the Pacific Ocean and on a few neighbouring islands. It belongs to a group of little-known ferns that have been around since before the time of the dinosaurs. Though tiny, its genetic material, or genome, is 50 times bigger than our own. And it's now been recognised by Guinness World Records as having the largest genome, the largest plant genome, and the largest fern genome. But big isn't always better when it comes to DNA. Dr. Ilya Leach of the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew says plants with large genomes are less nimble at adapting to change.
You've got to be able to replicate all that DNA. And if you're trying to replicate over 100 metres of DNA in each cell versus species with tiny genomes, which might be only a few centimetres of DNA, that takes a whole lot longer. So plants with bigger genomes are restricted to growing slower. Ultimate is that we think it also impacts extinction risk.
Dr. Leach says the study will help inform conservation efforts in the face of threats from biodiversity loss and climate change, and highlights the amazing diversity within the plant kingdom.
Helen Briggs. 50 years after they made pop history by winning the Eurovision Song Contest with their song Waterloo, the start of a long line of hits, the four members of ABBA have had a rare reunion. They were back together to receive one of Sweden's top honours at the Royal Palace in Stockholm from King Carl Gustaf. Stephanie Zachrisson has the details.
Artisten Agneta Fältskog, kommendör av första klassen av Kungliga Vasaorden, för mycket framstående insatser inom svensk och internationellt musikliv.
With pomp and circumstance, the ABBA four were handed a thank you for the music. King Carl Gustaf said the recipients were an inspiration to others and for future generations, as the awards for very distinguished contributions within Swedish and international music life were given to the pop stars. Sweden this year resumed the awarding of the Chivalry Orders after a 50-year pause, fittingly coinciding with the 50-year anniversary of ABBA's win in the Eurovision Song Contest with Waterloo, which catapulted them into global fame. The Royal Order of Vasa was created in the 1700s. The decision of who receives it is made by the government and parliament, but it's members of the public who put forward suggestions. So it might not have been that big of a surprise that Björn, Benny, Agneta and Annifrid were nominated.
I think it's amazing that we've been given this prize. I feel very honoured. And it does make me think of the 1970s and how the other musicians said we were too commercial. I'm feeling great today, and I'm sure some of these people would have loved to be in our place.
Since their breakthrough era of the 70s and their split in the early 80s, ABBA have sold an estimated 385 million records. Their music has spawned the hit musical Mamma Mia, two blockbuster movies, and the holographic performance ABBA Voyage. Although they are still good friends, they're rarely seen in public together. But Benny Andersson says it was an easy decision to reunite for this event.
It feels really, really good. And we thought this was so nice. We talked it over and said that we had to come, all four of us.
That was ABBA's Benny Andersson, ending that report by Stephanie Zachrisson. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Martin Baker. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.